or I understand that's you. You are the special assistant.
Well, I was the second one. I wasn't the first one. It was developed in the spring and summer of 1965, and Admiral Rayburn opted to set up a small staff in the director's office to supervise what the agency was doing with the Bridgman and the China problem. First, members of that staff were drawn from various components the agency had in the China-related responsibilities. And the first head of it was a guy named Peter Silva, who had been station chief in Saigon, and who had been badly wounded in the bombing, embassy bombing in March of that year, 65. And Pierre, I was asked to join the staff shortly after he got off the ground, and I'd been working on Indochina assessments in the Office of National Estimates, and I became the deputy chief of staff. And then when De Silva left a year later to go back out to Thailand to assist Graham Martin and some of Ambassador Martin's counterinsurgency programs in that country, why Dick Helms, who became Rayburn's successor as director, asked me to head the staff and be his special assistant for Vietnamese affairs, which I was for the balance of his tenure as director, and then doing Jim Schlesinger's tenure as director, and then doing part of Colby's tenure as director.
Is that up until 72 then?
No, I was head of the staff until September 73. Or October of 73, I can't remember exactly which.
Okay. Robert Comer comes out to Vietnam several times in late 1966.
Mm-hmm.
OCO has been formed, but it's not worked out.
Mm-hmm.
CORDS is going to be formed, and Robert Comer wants a general staff for pacification, which
mm-hmm.
is going to become ISEX.
Mm-hmm.
I believe John Hart coins the term. When is it decided that that SAVA is going to handle the training and organization of those first 44 men who are drawn from the military to staff out the region and province officers in ISEX?
Well, we didn't organize their training so much as we were the ones who laid out what we thought their training ought to be and ought to include. And it was more or less, I mean, since our responsibility was to the director to be sure that things connected with Indochina that need doing were done, and things that were unusual or hadn't been done before, we usually took a look at how we thought they ought to be saved to get them right in the first instance. So the notion of recommending how the training be done fell upon us, but I don't believe we did the actual training. In fact, I'm pretty sure we didn't, but we had a very small staff of not more than a dozen or so people, and we said we wouldn't have the facility to set up a large training program.
I understand from one of the guys who was in that class of 44 people that he got a notice in, he was at a military base in the United States, had done a tour in Vietnam in 65 and 66. His base commander got a message that this guy was going to be called to the Pentagon, and that was in April. Is it...
Of 65?
Of 67, just prior to the formation of ISEX.
Mm-hmm.
And that he went to Washington and met with you and Ruth Robertson. Was Ruth Robertson a person who played a role in the actual training program from the office of SAVA?
Well, to the best of my recollection, Robertson was in the agency's office of training at the time, and I think he did play a role in training the people who were then posted out to what became ISEX. And I may well have met with him and with some of the people who were going to be trained. I just simply don't recall. He would have been a natural fellow to have taken an active part in the training, if not actually run it. Because I say he was at the time, as I recall, a fairly senior officer in the office of training.
Mm-hmm.
So it's perfectly possible that a meeting, I don't happen to remember the actual meeting in question, but certainly possible that it took place. But basically what I would have been doing is looking from trying to see that the concept was adhere to, and then turning over its implementation to a guy who's better equipped and had more time to do it than I or any of my colleagues did.
Did Robert Comer come to you at some point and talk to you about the formation of ISEX?
Well, I'm sure he did. I mean, Bob and I dealt with each other quite frequently by memorandum, but usually by phone, or past personal crossing when he was in Washington. And then after he was in Vietnam, I used to go out there fairly often and visit some people back in Washington, and we saw each other. So I'm sure he did, but I can't remember any particular meeting at which this subject came.
You couldn't help me with the chronology then from late 66 until March, April of 67 when this thing gets together.
I'm afraid I can't simply because we're going off of memory, and I haven't thought about that subject for a very long time. My memory's just hazy.
Okay. But Robert Comer would have dealt directly with you in the in the setting up of the program.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Now,
and then you would have...
When Bob went to Saigon, I can't recall, he went out to be the head of Cords in some point during this period, because he was out there in 67, but when it was, and I believe he remained at that capacity until well into 1968. I think it was 68 that Bill Colby went out to replace him, but I'm not sure.
Okay.
Again, I just don't have total recall, and I just don't remember.
Okay. Can you tell me a little bit about the relationship between the Saigon station and your office as Special Assistant for Vietnam Affairs?
Well, it was an interesting relationship, which on the whole was fairly cordial, but I mean, the Saigon station, in terms of command line, reported to the Chief of the Far East Division, who in turn reported to the Deputy Director for Operations, who in turn reported to the Director. I was the head of the staff in the Director's office, which had a supervisory function for the director, and basically I looked after his Indochina account for him, but I had no command jurisdiction over the Saigon station per se, except that when I went on visits or if I would send the messages, they used to pay moderately respectful attention to me because they were well aware of the fact that I would then sit down and discuss my findings with the division chief, the DDO, and with the agency management committee, so there was no point in getting any more crossways with me than was necessary. But my relation with this succession of station chiefs, John Hart particularly, was very cordial indeed, except that our responsibilities, though overlapping and to some extent complementary, were by no means identical, and therefore I tried not to interfere with his discharge of his, and to a point he tried not to interfere with my discharge of mine, but I was responsible for satisfying myself and thus enabling me to certify the director that the Saigon station was performing about as it should and making the kind of contribution we wanted it to make to the overall U.S. effort in Indochina. And in that sense, I had something of an inspector general function, but I tried not to push that too hard.
When in late 1966, I understand, decision was made to expand the CIA role in pacification. There had been a debate whether the CIA should pull out of it, maintain the same policy, or get more involved. And the decision to get more involved was sort of what led to ISEX.
Well, it didn't exactly lead to it. I mean, it was felt by a number of people, myself included, that bashing away at North Vietnamese divisions was all very well, but that wasn't going to, the North Vietnamese could always pump more divisions in, so that really wasn't not going to get at the heart of the problem. And what you really needed to do was to assist the GVN in consolidating its control over the countryside with the bulk of the people left, and that was a task to which all elements of the U.S. mission that could make a contribution really ought to do so. That the military ought to construct some of their operations, as the Marines did notably up in I Corps, to assist that function, which was kind of a long-range win-the-war function. I mean, you had to bash the North Vietnamese to prevent defeat, but you had to consolidate the government's hold in the countryside if you wanted to win the war. So I think that the expanded CIA role was part and parcel of an expanded embassy role, an expanded AID role, and even expanded military role. And there's nothing that any individual mission component went off and did on its own.
Okay, so it's just the shift to pacification.
Yeah.
Okay. Ralph Johnson wrote a dissertation in 1981 and 82, just before he passed away, mm-hmm. on Phoenix. I don't know if you're aware of that.
Yeah, I'm aware, but I've never read it and I wanted to.
In it, he mentioned that he was deeply involved in his abstract to the dissertation, that he was deeply involved in Phoenix, but in the text he didn't explain how. What kind of involvement would the CIA and Ralph Johnson have had in the Phoenix program after 1969, when the program was theoretically turned over to the military and the CIA had withdrawn from it?
Well, Ralph, I don't know exactly what periods Ralph was referring to. As I said, I've never seen his dissertation or its abstract, or very much like to read it. Where did he do it, you know?
American University.
Ralph was very heavily involved in training activities in Vietnam, down at the training center in Vinh Tau, and it may well have been in that capacity that he may well have been kept on after the military took the program over. I don't recall this for a fact, but it was certainly logical, because he was very good and he had a lot of experience in sort of personal institutional memory.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember him, recall his being more involved with the training of cadre and personnel than the actual management of operations in the field. So again, I could be mistaken.
That would have been revolutionary development.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Likewise, would Phil Potter and Rod Landrette have had a role in the Phoenix program? Would you have known what their responsibilities were?
Well, Rod had some sort of special assistance function in the station. He could have had Phoenix-related responsibilities. I'm not saying that he didn't. I just don't remember precisely what things Rod was involved in. I know he was responsible, among other things, for various dealings with senior levels of the GBN,
mm-hmm.
but I forget on precisely what substance it was. And I don't really remember Phil Potter was out there. I think he was up in 3 Corps. But precisely what he was doing, I just simply don't recall. I mean, I knew Phil. In fact, Phil had been branch chief when I first went to Vietnam in 1958. But I don't have a vivid recollection for precisely where he fit in the overall scheme of things.
Which branch?
The FE Branch 4, which was the Indochina branch. See, Phil served in Vietnam. I think he was stationed in Hanoi in the 52-54 period.
Okay. I believe Evan Parker was there at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
This one province guy that I talked with, who had been in the, was one of the original 44, mm-hmm. who went over and as part of ISAC's province officers,
mm-hmm.
said that his mailbox was the Combined Studies Group. Can you tell me what this Combined Studies Group is?
I think it was an administrative name used for people who were operating as a sort of umbrella to cover people who were operating the ISAC program, to the best of my recollection.
Okay, but would it have been an office itself, perhaps in the Cords building, handling reports or something like that?
It may well have been, or offices that were handling the reports may have been combined under that banner. I just simply don't remember, but it was probably the name administratively and organizationally used for people who were assigned to this particular program.
Okay. Would you know anybody who would have been involved in that I could go to for information about the Combined Studies Group?
Well, there's Parker, if he's still alive.
He is. Okay. If there's a Combined Studies Group, what would be, how would it relate to the Phoenix Directorate? Wouldn't that be a sort of duplication effort?
Again, I don't know I don't remember who was doing what under what name and what time period. It could well have been a component of the Phoenix Directorate, or it could have been the U.S. administrative entity to which people working on Phoenix problems were assigned. I just simply don't recall. I think it was an administrative umbrella term, but at least I'm pretty sure it was, but I forget the years in which it was used, and I forget just exactly how broad an ambit it had.
Okay. Would you be aware of any kind of CIA role in Phoenix after the ceasefire?
After the ceasefire? You mean after 75?
After 73. 73 is ceasefire, and then and at that point American troops have been withdrawn.
Yeah, and didn't the Phoenix program pretty well phase down or close down by then?
That there's some debate as to whether or not it did. It was actually, supposedly it was handed over totally to the Vietnamese National Police.
Yeah, it was.
Okay. Wouldn't it have been monitored by the station?
Well, there were a couple of station officers who had advisory liaison functions with the National Police, and then that, to the extent they were kept their eyes and ears open as to what the police were doing with the formerly partially the larger U.S. account, but there was no active U.S. involvement that I recall in Phoenix after it was turned over.
Okay. Right. No more staffing of DIOCs and PIOCs and all that kind of stuff. But just kind of a monitoring and awareness of the program.
That's my recollection, because all this was turned over and the district and the provincial operating centers were manned by Vietnamese, but no given for further U.S. personnel.
Okay. Last question. Mm-hmm. What's your assessment of ISECs in Phoenix, its impact on the war and its success, or not on lack of success?
I think it was basically a very good concept. I think it had, it was related to something that had to be done. And I think on the whole, how much of this you can attribute to any single program, no one knows. I think on the whole, the government was, by and large, reasonably successful, a lot more than it was given credit at the time, or since has been given credit since, particularly by true believers who didn't like it, in winning, if not the affection of the people, their allegiance, if only of a very pragmatic way. I have a friend whom you ought to go out and talk to, by the name of Sam Popkin, who now works for the Yankovic Polling Organization and is a professor at some component of the University of California system, I think at Irvine or Santa Clara, I forget which. I don't think Sam's on the Berkeley campus. But Sam, in the late 60s, was a rising star at either Harvard or MIT, I think Harvard. And Sam has a great cross to bear in life. He's an intellectually honest Marxist, and that's not a very easy thing for anyone to be. And Sam got himself a grant and went out to Vietnam to study popular attitudes towards the war and the government, whatever. And when he left, he was given a big send-off by all the best people at Harvard. Because they just knew that Sam was going to come back and tell them how all the Vietnamese peasants were thirsting for the revolution and couldn't wait to depose the vicious Saigon government. Well, Sam was a very gutsy guy, and his mode of conducting research was both thorough and courageous. He would go out and live for weeks and months on end in villages down the Delta, where he would be the only non-Vietnamese for dozens of miles around, and there was nobody to protect him or bail him out if he got him in trouble. And after spending 12, 18, 24, however many months he spent doing his research, collecting a whole companion of notes and interviews and stuff, he came back, and he was welcomed back initially with open arms. And they said, oh, now tell us all these wonderful things you found out, how everybody, all the peasantry, supports the NLF. And he said, well, a little bit more complicated than that. That's sort of what I thought I was going to find, but I found that that wasn't the way it worked. I found out peasants tend to be conservative, and the thing that they like least is paying taxes. And the only thing they like less than paying one set of taxes is paying two sets of taxes. And they tend to view the war as a struggle between two sets of large tax collectors. And by and large, if they had their druthers, many, if not most of them, would rather give their support to the tax collectors from whom they derive some benefit. Tended to be immediate, and the NLS benefits tended to be off in the indeterminate future. That by and large, most people you talk to would just as soon pay their taxes to government and wish the NLF would get the hell off their backs, not because they had any great sort of ideological feeling for or against communism, but simply because in their perspective, they like to be able to throw their transistor radio in the back of their P-Rogue and slap on their little outboard motor and scoot into the district town for sell some of their rice and mm-hmm. listen to a little gossip and generally enjoy themselves.
Just enjoy life,
that's
right?
That's right. And when South Vietnam finally fell, it did not fall to any sort of popular rising. Mm-hmm. It fell to 18-line divisions of the North Vietnamese Army, a series of battles in which the NLF and the indigenous element, the southern elements of the force structure played no role of any consequence whatsoever. So mm-hmm. If that was the end result, more or less produced, I'm not saying that Phoenix necessarily produced it, but that the government programs working towards achieving that kind of end can't have been all bad or entirely misconceived.
Okay.
Now, this is the kind of thing that's not susceptible to sort of quantified analysis, and you can't say that this program was responsible for 72.3% of this shift in the sort of Hamlet statistics or anything like that. But I think the job that Phoenix tried to do was necessary to do, and I think that the overall attitudes that were prevailing by 1975, the overall attitudes of prevailing countries survived, with exceptions in certain areas and certain regions, of course, by and large indicated that the government's efforts to sell its message to the bulk of its rural population had on the whole been successful. Or at least hadn't been miserable failures.
And I'd also like to get your opinion on one of your fellow workers, a man named Nelson Brickham.
Don't remember, except by name.
Okay. Well, I tried to make it as...
Okay,
I know how busy you are, so I tried to keep it to a precious few.
Frida wasn't all that...
I'll just put it closer to you, okay?
Pretty much what we were concerned with in the directorate there was the personnel and training side of the activity. We had a program there that was spread out all over Vietnam, in every region and every province and every district. And what we had to do was be sure that we had the necessary resources to fulfill what our responsibilities were, and that those resources were properly trained, or at least oriented when they got into the country as to what their responsibilities were, and that they were properly supported logistically. That's essentially what we did.
Was the military providing the logistical support?
Yes. Because, you see, we were, the Phung Wong Directorate was concerned with the military side of the operation. The Phung Wong Directorate of Courts.
And yet,
this was under Mac V, under the General Abrams, and we had our own chief there, who was at one point Colby, and then George Jacobson was replaced him. And then we were under a further director, there were a couple of general officers at different times, and Forrester, primarily, Gene Forrester. And then came our director, but our director didn't mm-hmm. really. He reported to two places.
You mean either Mason or Tilton?
I mean Mason or Tilton. Yeah, they had two places to report because they came from the agency, and they also were responsible through the court structure up to Mac V.
Were there other CIA officers on the Phoenix staff?
Not in the directorate I worked in. And I don't know of any other place where they might have been. This was a military program.
I had heard that there was a fellow who was a lieutenant colonel in logistics, which I believe was the S4, a man with a French accent. Does that ring any bells to you?
No.
Who was supposedly not a the other military officers maybe knew that he was not a regular army
maybe
officer.
Maybe if there were a name attached to that guy, I might be able to remember.
I don't have a name, just...
He might have been a reserve officer. Called active duty, or he might have been from time to time. See, a number of agency officers did hold reserve commissions and actually came on active duty for short periods, as all reservists do. Now, I don't know, or maybe that guy was in that category.
I was, one of the things I'm trying to determine is what kind of monitoring of the program the CIA did. They started the program, staffed it originally, and then gradually withdrew from it.
As I understand, and I wasn't even there, but they had to pull back when they got such publicity in 69 or 70 when they had some allegations of assassinations and things with the ship. So Colonel Rowe was involved in a special forces guy. I don't really know anything about that other than what I read in the newspaper at the time. I do know that that changed the whole program. They decided to, in effect, go public with this program.
Can you tell me a little bit how the staff was organized? Were there several departments? Was there a reports department, computer department? That kind of a organizational structure.
It's very. I really can't remember exactly how that was organized. We had a logistics department there, and we had I was operations, and we didn't really, as I recall, have anything that had anything to do with intelligence because we weren't operational when it came to intelligence. We didn't process intelligence in any way. We were strictly administrative and logistical.
Did you participate in planning operations in the field?
No. See, that's why the sort of a misnomer when it's called chief of operations. It was operations.
It seems to suggest that, yeah.
But it's operations in keeping the program functional. I also gave the director one senior man on the staff that he could go to do a number of different tasks that might need to be done. So he had requirements that came down from his, from courts.
Okay.
In any way. We were strictly administrative and logistical.
Did you participate in planning operations in the field?
No.
Okay.
See, that's why the sort of a misnomer when it's called chief of operations. It was operations.
It seems to suggest that, yeah.
Yeah, but it's operations in keeping the program functional. I also gave the director one senior man on his staff that he could go to do a number of different tasks that might need to be done. He had requirements that came down from his, from courts.
Okay.
We had a lot of reporting requirements, but most of them had to do with the types of people that we had, our requirements, maybe for additional spaces of people, and the types of training and the types of military occupational specialties we needed.
And was Carl Molly a deputy for you? And then he later became chief of operations?
I'm not sure if he did after I left, but I know that he was, I think he was my senior deputy at that time. Senior, I didn't have any deputies. I had about three or four. But during that period, there was another guy named Hudnall, I believe it was.
Hudman.
George Hudman, yeah. George is a colorful guy.
I saw a picture of him. Yeah. John Tilton had a picture of him that had been taken with the whole staff.
Yeah, Tubman even had his wife over there for a while, which is kind of unusual in Vietnam. You just didn't normally see that.
Did you know the region coordinators?
Yeah, I got to know him fairly well.
Did you know John Johnson? Was he one year?
I don't recall John Johnson.
Okay. George Carey, who I believe is a black man.
We had a... I don't remember the names of these guys.
Was one Dave Muckett?
Well, we had up in the northern region, we had a guy who, up in the first region, a guy who ended up going to later on, he was a foreign area specialist. See, most of these guys were career military intelligence officers. This guy was also a Japanese area specialist, a linguist, and when he left there, he went to Japan as defense attaché for several years.
Was he Japanese?
No, but he was very good at his, which he spent many years doing. See, I was also a foreign area specialist, but I was not a military intelligence officer.
Okay. Is that the MOS 47, I believe that is?
No. No, the military intelligence specialty, that is what you were talking about.
Yeah.
Foreign area specialists have different 4,800 to 48 different numbers after the 48, depending on the area that they're specialists in. A lot of military intelligence officers are also foreign area specialists. Like, for instance, Carl Moeller was a Latin American specialist.
Okay.
And we might have had a couple of others who were cycling through there, since everybody had to do their time in Vietnam. You know, no matter where your specialty was, somewhere else in the world, when you came your turn, you had to go.
Had to
I was
go.
One of the last artillery officers to go to Vietnam.
Because
in the early stages of Vietnam, they sent me to Korea to be a battalion commander.
Can you tell me the name of the fellow who was the Japanese area specialist who went to Japan?
No, I wish I could. That name is so vague. I just remember I was very impressed with him. And later on, as a defense attaché, I would read some of his reports. And I know he was very highly regarded by the Defense Intelligence Agency. And they had a bald-headed lieutenant colonel, kind of a outgoing type in Region 2.
Millet?
No, I know Millet.
Okay.
No, it wasn't Millet. Millet was not, he was in our program, that's right. Yeah, he came into that. He came into the region. He replaced this other guy.
Do you remember his name?
Now, Millet was a very senior colonel, though.
Mm-hmm.
At that point. He's senior to me.
I asked John Tilton who gave Millet orders, and he said God.
That's about right. Millet was a... He was a free spirit, you know. I think he was straight as he could be, you know, but he was really an infantry colonel out of the water. He really should have been out in front of a battalion or a regiment. So.
Do you remember the name of the bald-headed lieutenant colonel?
I sure don't.
Did you deal with any Vietnamese?
No, not on a regular basis. From time to time, in visiting, however, throughout the regions, I would, of course, be hosted by local, either national police, or in some cases, special police officers who were the senior people in the district or in the province. But I don't know of any of them, hardly. We did get to know the National Police Chief pretty well. It's part of our representational type responsibilities, in receptions and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
We would be in contact with the Chief of National Police.
Bin, General Bin?
don't think that's what his name. This guy at Tilton did pretty well.
Was it Hong?
Yeah, it was
glasses.
Hong. Yeah, that was it. It was. Yeah. Tilton did him pretty well. It was part of his job. He had to know this guy. He was this guy.
Was there a person on the staff who was a liaison to the special branch?
I don't recall anybody on that staff being liaison to the special branch. We had, that function was done by the chief, by Tilton,
okay.
As far as I can recall.
How long were you there till?
1 year. I left in February of 1971.
In 72.
72, yeah, I got there in 72.
About
a year.
Were you replaced by someone?
I don't think my replacement was there when I left. Okay. If he was, he didn't impress me very much.
How big a staff? How many people in the Phoenix Directorate? Perhaps a little ago.
I think we had about 15 people there. Seemed like, including the enlisted assistants that we had. There was a couple of, that includes we had two interpreters, or translator interpreters, there were Vietnamese women. We had a couple of U.S. secretaries, females who were there working for the government, U.S. government. About 15 people in all was our report. Some guys probably have all these, still have little charts and things.
That's what I really would like to see, an organizational chart. I suppose there must be some table of organization,
somebody
isn't there?
Must have them somewhere, but most of us toss that stuff.
Okay.
Probably Vietnam, because that was something when you came back, you said, well, I've done a good job,
Did you then get assigned to Latin America?
Well, I got assigned back to the Department of the Army Staff Operations again, back into the Latin American field. And then after two more years attending the War College and the Inter-American Defense College, for a year I did go back to Latin America.
Do you see any lessons to be learned from Phoenix to be applied in Latin America or elsewhere around the world?
Well, not necessarily. Well, yeah, Phoenix, the way we were operating Phoenix, this was strictly an intelligence program. We were, and intelligence is probably the most important thing when you're trying to deal with a subversive movement and a subversion. Type warfare. You've got people who are moving around you every day who are your enemy, and you don't know who they are. So you've got to know who they are, and the way you've got to get a handle on it. And that's what we were trying to do. Our target was what they call the VCI, the Viet Cong infrastructure, and we were trying to set up a sort of a systemized organization where we could collect, collate, analyze, in an organized manner, intelligence on these VCI.
So would you sort of describe the Phoenix Directorate as basically administrative, handling paperwork that came in from the provinces? And
administrative, just the operational areas. Mm-hmm. As far as the intelligence operations were actually at the province and at the district level, even at the regional level, there was really no operations. We had in every district, almost every district, 270 some odd districts there, and in every province, there was something like 48 or 40, what is it?
44.
44 provinces, and then some other regions that really weren't considered provinces. Every one of those had a intelligence center.
Right, dioxin clouds.
That's right. And that's what we were concerned with. And our people who went out in the field, it was their job to be sure that they were established and properly supervised.
Did the Phoenix director handle the financing of the program?
We had the financing as far as our people were concerned, yes. Now, I really don't know. I can't recall. But I think that that our people in the field, in the district and the province level, had limited funds that they could use in setting up these structures, the actual centers that were operating. And they were able to get supplies for them, such as file cabinets and maybe communications and that sort of thing.
What about money for their operations?
The operations that they would then conduct.
Yeah, for instance, if they were running agents in the field or stuff like that.
That did not come from our side because we were concerned with the intelligence side. We would produce the intelligence in the field, they would. And to see the district chief, they were reporting to the district chief and the province chief. They had their own assets as far as what they did with that intelligence and how they exploited the intelligence. See, our guys in the field were working on the staff of the senior district advisor and the senior province advisor.
Right. The district Phoenix guy was advisor to the district senior advisor.
That's right. Who was
right.
Advising the district chief?
The district chief, right.
And they each had their counterparts all over down the line.
Did you do a lot of traveling around the country?
I wouldn't say a lot, but I did, periodically I would travel. I went to every region two or three times to various districts within the regions, but not. We really didn't have a lot of business, going in and trying to second guess what they were doing operationally. What we were concerned about was that our people on the ground, that the province senior advisors, district senior advisors, were getting what they expected out of our people. You know, it was really a people sort of thing. If the guys were out there goofing off, we wanted to know about it.
And that you learned through the reporting systems?
We learned, through the reporting system, through our contacts with the advisors. Of course, we could also, sometimes in our visits out there, we could see if they might be using them improperly. Okay. Now, for instance, the province senior advisor might be having our highly trained intelligence guy doing something on his staff that really wasn't what he was sent out there to do. Might have him writing reports for him that didn't have anything to do with his business.
Okay.
Being his supply officer or something like that.
So you are actually an Accords employee while you're in the Phoenix directorate?
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. We were.
Anybody on the Phoenix directorate that is working for Accords?
That's right.
Okay.
We were all, and that's where our reporting chain went as far as our efficiency reports, and they were right up that chain.
How long did you get to know John Mason at all?
Only for about 6 weeks when I first arrived there. He was already winding down. He knew he was leaving.
How would you describe his management style as opposed to John Tilden's? Could you make a comparison?
No, I really wasn't with him that long. He was an informal type manager, sort of a, I really don't know that guy, but I would be, drawing conclusions that I don't have the basis to draw.
Did you get along well with John Tilden?
Yeah, I got along real well with John. I got to know him pretty well.
He of course, spent most of his career in Latin America.
Yeah, and although I didn't know that initially, but later on we did. You see, guys from his agency don't talk much about what they do.
No.
And I did ask him a few questions when I found out that he had been in Bolivia to ask him how that went, because I was also in Argentina when that was going on. I had some good friends who were involved in that up there.
Had you been in Bolivia?
Yeah, I visited Bolivia a couple of times. One of my good friends had been the senior infantry advisor to the Bolivian Army in Cochabamba, which is where these operations emanated from.
There's John Tilden is rumored to have been the man who organized the capture of Che Guevara.
Yeah, he was there, and he was in charge of what was going on.
Yeah, so there's...
But the guy, the Green Beret guy, was a guy named Patrick Shelton.
Shelton.
Yeah. Was down there, and you know, they work in a country team type basis. They come in, and the ambassador, of course, has a lot to say about what they do and what they don't do. And station chief does.
Did you know Pat Shelton? Yeah. I've lived pretty close to Fort Devens,
right?
10 miles away. So I have a couple of friends who are retired special forces guys. Who are writing, have, you know, ambitions to write, so we get together and talk.
There's some very colorful people who've been in that business, very much so. He's one of them, although certainly not the only one.
No. Interesting. Well, I think that pretty much covers the questions I had. I was hoping that you might remember some of the region people, because I'd like to get in touch with them.
Well, we lost a few in helicopter accidents, things like that. We might be friends.
Dave Mallory.
His name escapes me right now. It's not Lieutenant Kirk. I think at the same time I did, he went down to the helicopter, and he was a regional coordinator.
Mm-hmm.
And this happened to quite a few people. There's another one down in the